a global plea for unity today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. This election has thrown America's divisions into stark relief. But worldwide, a new generation is fed up.
We need to work together to fix some of the biggest problems facing my generation right now. So I think that we can't be isolationists about this. And I think that we know that we have to work together. And we want a candidate that is going to support those efforts.
Plus, a reporter meets a family who escaped from the Islamic State.
For the first time in more than 2 years, they were able to sleep well. And when I asked them why, they said because it was the first time that they were able to sleep without fear.
And a first-time immigrant voter can't wait for Tuesday.
I am very excited to be part of that force that we're going to show on November 8th.
That's all coming up today here on The World. When America picks a new president, the entire globe holds its breath. Any other year, that might be an exaggeration. This time around, it is pretty close to the truth. A lot at stake for people all around the world. In a few minutes, we'll hear why China is worried that U.S. climate policy could change after the election. First, though, if there is one place that's felt the impact of U.S. foreign policy more than any other region, it's probably the Middle East. In fact, people there are paying very close attention to the election here, as we hear now from the world's Richard Hall in Beirut.
I looked at a couple of polls that were conducted last month that looked really in detail at how the Arab world, that's basically the Middle East and North Africa, how the Arab world was viewing this presidential election, who they wanted to win, and also what they thought about American foreign policy in general. And so one of the numbers that one of the polls came up with was that 60% of people in the Arab world are following the U.S. presidential race on a regular or occasional basis. So there really is great interest in this campaign, in this election.
Yeah, so 60%, that's a lot of people. And are those people, what do the polls say? Are they hoping for a Hillary Clinton win or a Donald Trump win on Tuesday?
It's Hillary Clinton that they want to win, and it's not even close. So the first poll, which was carried out across 18 countries, they found that 44% would go for Clinton and just 9% for Trump. And a separate poll of leading Arab nations, that's just a slightly fewer than the previous poll, found that 66% preferred Clinton and just 11% for Trump. What's interesting about both of those polls is the lack of enthusiasm for either candidate. One of those polls found that 47% of people wouldn't vote for either candidate.
What ranks as the top concerns for people in North Africa and the Middle East when they're asked about American foreign policy?
They asked the respondents what should be the most pressing issue for the next president. And top of that list was that the U.S. should not intervene in the Arab world. So people are kind of tired of U.S. intervention on the whole. The second issue was that the U.S. should focus on combating the Islamic State. Now, those two things sound kind of contradictory when you hear them together. But the general opinion is that the U.S. policy, at least, had a hand in paving way for the rise of the Islamic State. So there's kind of a sense that the U.S. should play its part in fixing the mess that it made.
That's kind of weird because there's also a sense among some critics that Donald Trump would actually be a dream president for ISIS. There's even a sense from ISIS that they'd like to see Donald Trump as president. Can you explain that?
If I had to guess at the intentions of the Islamic State, why they wanted Trump to be president, I think they probably assumed that he would be a more chaotic, a more unpredictable president than Hillary Clinton. They can kind of guess what Hillary Clinton's going to do. And there is some hint in some countries that people see in Donald Trump this kind of strongman figure that the Middle East is so familiar with in places like Egypt and other places. So there is a slim amount of support for Donald Trump for that reason.
When it comes to issues, Richard, is the concept of a Palestinian state for the Palestinians still a platform that people in the Mideast want to hear articulated from an American presidential candidate? Is that still kind of the litmus test for whom they would support?
Not necessarily, actually. It depends country by country. In Tunisia, for example, Hillary Clinton was quite popular. She had a 65% approval rating. That's because during her time as Secretary of State, she actually supported the democratic transition. This was the first country in the wave of countries that found democracy in the Arab Spring. She's viewed very favorably there. Interestingly, it's in the Palestinian territories where she's the least popular. And that's because of America's longstanding support for Israel. And Hillary Clinton is kind of seen as a pro-Israel candidate. Donald Trump, too, actually. But Hillary Clinton, during her time as Secretary of State, was a friend to Israel.
Final question, Richard. Was there anything else in these polls about U.S. foreign policy that people in the Mideast hope might change under the next president?
Yeah, I think people here just kind of look at both of the candidates and there's kind of a cynicism towards U.S. foreign policy. They've kind of seen a trend going all the way back to the 1990s. No matter who's president, the U.S. is going to meddle over here and they're tired of it. They don't want the U.S. to intervene here anymore. But Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, they just don't think it's going to change. And they will point to the last 30 years as the reason why they think that.
The World's Richard Hall is our man in Beirut. Thank you as always, Richard.
Thanks, Marco.
We were curious about how people all over the globe were feeling about the election, especially millennials, since we've been hearing a lot about, let's say, the lack of enthusiasm among young people in this country ahead of the vote. Right now at PRI.org, we're running a live straw poll. We're asking people in any country which presidential candidate they would vote for if they had a vote and why. Caitlin Aber helped put that poll together. She's a millennial herself.
Well, what's so interesting about this survey is that it's international. It's not just about the United States. And I think that really speaks to a lot of the concerns millennials have. We are a global nation. We care about the rest of the world. And we want to know what they have to say about this really volatile election, because no matter which candidate wins on November 8th, it's going to have a major impact on young people throughout the world. So I really wanted to know what they had to say and how they felt. And PRI really wanted to know, you know, what could be said about this new generation that's going to have so much power in a few years?
So you've had tens of thousands of respondents. What have you learned?
Well, we've learned a lot. We've learned that the majority of people are supporting Hillary Clinton. We've learned through comments that they've left about their fears about a Trump presidency, but also that they're not satisfied with either of these candidates, that they don't feel that either of these people represent both their values and what America stands for. On an international level, that means, you know, they want somebody that they can mirror. They want somebody who they can count on to not damage their own country. So it's a really broad spectrum of responses as to why they're voting for Hillary Clinton, but the majority of people are.
So, you know, millennials often say they're put off by politicians. That's actually a theme in the past year and a half. Did that show up in your results?
Absolutely. Millennials are just kind of, I guess, shocked at how the way this election has turned out, the way that, you know, they're forced to make a choice between two people they don't feel represent them. And they are also still wonderfully optimistic. And I think that you saw that a lot with, you know, how many millennials really stood for Bernie Sanders and how many millennials are still holding on to third party candidates. They want a better country for themselves and their children, and they aren't willing to just accept the status quo much longer.
I mean, this is fascinating stuff, but in the xenophobic climate right now in this country, are you getting pushback from people here in the United States, kind of like, what do we care what the rest of the world thinks of, you know, our politics?
I don't think that that's a millennial perspective at all. I think millennials see, you know, this, like I said, a global nation where we want to help each other. We want to stop all of these wars that we're in. We don't want to cause more trouble. And we need to work together to fix some of the biggest problems facing my generation right now, such as global warming. So I think that we can't be isolationists about this. And I think that we know that we have to work together and we want a candidate that is going to support those efforts.
Has this survey changed how you feel about the future, your future?
This whole unconvention project that we've been working on in conjunction with PRI, Mike, and 92nd Street Y has really left me hopeful, actually. I went into it thinking, you know, there's only so much to learn, but I've wrapped up feeling like, wow, we are a great generation and anything is possible.
Wow, that's really great to hear on this Friday before the election. I was feeling kind of negative. You kind of changed that.
I think that more young people will be running for office very soon, and I'm very excited about that.
Caitlin Aber in New York. Thanks for keeping us posted. You can still vote in Caitlin's straw poll, by the way. It's live at PRI.org. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
China is also watching our election closely for many reasons, but this one might surprise you. Chinese officials are worried about the U.S. backing out of the global climate agreement. GOP nominee Donald Trump has threatened to do just that if he's elected. And today, for the second time in a week, a Chinese official criticized Trump's stance. The message from China is basically this: pulling out of the climate deal would be unwise and hurt America's standing in the world. China usually doesn't comment on foreign elections, so these were pretty rare statements this week. The World's Patrick Nguyen is following the story from Bangkok. How exactly did China push back on candidate Trump, Patrick?
Very mildly. They said that if he were a wise leader, he would be responsive to world trends. I know that sounds extremely dull and not much like a rebuke, but coming from China, it qualifies as a rebuke. They have a policy of non-interference in foreign countries' elections. So to say anything at all, even mildly critical, it shows that they are not happy with Trump's climate change views.
Yeah, not just unhappy, but I mean, if they almost never comment directly on foreign political candidates, it seems really out on the fringe. Does it suggest that climate change is a hot-button issue for them?
Well, they're pretty happy that the United States and China are so simpatico on climate change these days. There are so many areas where China and America are clashing. Let's, you know, remind ourselves that China sees itself as encircled by U.S. military bases. There's plenty of ways that China and the U.S. don't get along. Trade deals, for example. But on climate change, they're finally getting along, and they don't want another candidate to come along and, you know, just tip the table over.
Yeah, and what about Trump's position specifically disturbs Beijing so much?
The idea that he would back out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, and this is an agreement by pretty much every nation on Earth that will try, at least try, to keep the Earth from warming above 2 degrees Celsius, above pre-industrial levels. And let's remind ourselves, you know, if it gets to 3 or 4, we're talking about much of the planet looking like a wasteland. So every country has a strong incentive to stick with this deal. So, yeah, China doesn't want to upset that, and Trump has suggested that climate change is a Chinese hoax. So, you know,
it's kind of counterintuitive because my impulse is to believe that China would want to back out of the treaty, all things being equal. They're going through an economic slump after a big economic boom, and making more stuff would be good for them. Does this suggest that China really is taking the climate change threat seriously? And, you know, all those stories of the U.S. trying to chase China down at the Copenhagen summit, that's a thing of the past.
Yeah, thankfully, it's looking more antiquated. Let's give China a little bit more credit. They use actually 4 times as much clean energy as the U.S. does. In the last 3 or 4 years, they've really, really pushed green energy hard. They're going really hard with solar. And let's also remind ourselves that the average American uses 3 times as much energy as does the average Chinese person. So there's really not much high ground between the U.S. and China. We're talking about the number one and the number two polluter on Earth, respectively.
Does China see hope in Hillary Clinton? Is that kind of the takeaway from this rebuke of Trump?
I think that's a little too simple. Maybe on climate change, yeah, they know that she's going to stay the course. They have their own issues with Hillary Clinton. She is seen as someone who wags her finger when it comes to human rights issues. She's seen as someone who has not an aggressive military policy, but a fairly robust one. There are probably corners of the Chinese elite who think Trump coming along would sort of destabilize the U.S. and China could take advantage. But Hillary has her own issues with the Chinese. Climate change is not one of them.
The World's Patrick Nguyen speaking with us from Bangkok. Thanks as always, Patrick.
Thanks, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. In South Africa, college students have been protesting for months now. They're demanding free tuition for everyone. Most of the demonstrations have been peaceful, but that is starting to change. Some protesters have set fires to libraries and lecture halls. Kim Kluti has more from Cape Town.
Many South Africans support the call for free education for the poor, at the very least. But recently, protests have taken a more militant turn. Last month at the University of Cape Town, students barricaded entrances to campus, burst into buildings, set off fire alarms, and insisted that staff leave the premises. At one point, a couple of protesters broke free from the crowd, turned on a security guard, trampling him and beating him with a metal bar.
No!
2 days later, I sit down with Sanawo Tambo, second-year student and protest leader, to try to understand why the protests have become so intense.
It's in the Constitution that education is a basic right for everyone. So the issue we have with fees is that they exclude the majority of people who are in this country because it puts a price tag on education.
According to the latest statistics, black students are 5 times less likely to study at university than white students. Money is a huge problem. Students can get loans, but they rack up debt. Tambo says he can't afford to pay back loans as he's expected to financially support his extended family as soon as he gets a job.
Basically, my entire family is dependent on me actually getting this degree and getting a job.
He says the protests aren't just about fees, though. They're also about what he and fellow activists call decolonization.
By decolonized education, we mean that the education that's being taught in our institutions must speak to the lived experiences and needs of black people in the country. So we must be able to see ourselves in our curriculum, and it mustn't be Eurocentric.
I asked Tambo if he condones the violence that's come with the protests.
Students are not going all out to be violent and to fight or to burn or to destroy anything. But it's always a response. On the side of students, it's a retaliation to the day-to-day sort of antagonisms and provoking of student protests.
Across the country, students have accused police of brutality for firing stun grenades and rubber bullets at them. More than 500 protesters have been arrested. Some students have been injured in clashes with police and have landed up in hospital. The government has appealed for calm, but students are not giving up.
We are here to issue a warning to this country that if it doesn't release all political prisoners, that if we don't get free decolonial education now, we'll shut this country down.
A few days after the campus protests turned violent, students from the 4 universities in and around Cape Town converged on the Parliament building downtown. They handed a list of demands to the National Minister of Finance. The protests started peacefully, but then unraveled when one or two students flung bottles at police. Police retaliated.
It looks like it's hotting up. Glass bottles, bricks being thrown at the police. The police are retaliating, and they've just brought on a whole extra few trucks of extra policemen in riot gear.
Then bricks were hurled, and a student was hit on the head.
Tense here at the moment. It's so tense. One protest is down. He's been hit badly.
It's hard to know where things will go from here. With violence escalating, the university cancelled all lectures for a few weeks. The University of Cape Town hopes to reopen on Monday to start the end-of-year exams. But with protesters vowing to continue, many students fear they won't be able to complete the year.
What would you say to criticism that perhaps you are holding 26,000 students ransom here while you carry on with the protests?
We're also holding ourselves at ransom, I think. So we are not people who are against universities functioning, but we want them to change. And this is the moment that they should change, because we're not going to protest annually for the same thing and not get any results.
As a young person, what is your perception of change since 1994, since the advent of democracy?
I think the world must get over its obsession with 1994 as a victory. What happened post-1994 and from 1994 was that there was no real reconciliation. It was as if there was no one who supported apartheid. Everyone who supported apartheid prior to 1994 just magically disappeared, and we were all supposed to work together. We were all supposed to be one big happy family, while the tangible issues that face black people at an economical level, at an institutional level, and a structural level were never resolved. There's been no tangible change for black people in South Africa.
Tambo sees the current protests as part of a much bigger struggle. For The World, Kim Clutie, Cape Town.
All this week, we've been hearing from Americans who will be voting for the first time on Tuesday, people like Juan Freitas Mora. He's a documentary filmmaker from Venezuela who moved to the U.S. when he was 23. He's now 39. He became a U.S. citizen just last year and lives in Phoenix.
The last time I voted was the referendum. Hugo Chavez was the president of Venezuela. It was 2007, and it was to change the constitution to get rid of term limits. I supported a lot of the ideas that he had. I didn't support everything, but that was my breaking point. In Venezuela, it's usually a day off or a Sunday where people or a Saturday. You know, like a weekend where people don't work and they can go vote. In the United States, it's not. And in fact, I was talking to my wife yesterday, and she was like, you know, I'm afraid that I'm not going to have time to go vote because I don't know if they're going to let me at work. And I don't know if there's going to be huge lines. And I was like, you know, that's not right that they don't allow you to get out of work to go vote. it should be a holiday and should be like, you know, this day no one works because everyone should go vote. You know, I moved to Phoenix and there's a lot of protests going on about the immigration issues in the country. And I was with my camera running around and my wife was worried about me. I'm a legal resident and everything, but she was worried about me. And she was like, you know what? You need to become a citizen because you never know what can happen. And I don't want to have you deported or anything like that. I'm really nervous about November 8th. I am also very excited because I think Donald Trump should be defeated. And I think Donald Trump should be defeated by women and minorities. Like, I didn't understand well the Latino vote, I think, until I moved to Phoenix and to Arizona. I don't know, I was a little bit detached from being a bloc that votes together. And they talk about, you know, the sleeping giant and how we can actually influence elections. And, like, I think we still need to show our force. And I am very excited to be part of that force that we're going to show on November 8th.
Documentary filmmaker Juan Freites Mora in Phoenix, Arizona. On Tuesday, he'll be voting for the first time as a U.S. citizen.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC, World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's been a few years since the war in Iraq made so many headlines over here. After all, most U.S. troops left the country years ago, but we're hearing a lot from Iraq lately because of the battle going on in Mosul. The Iraqi army, with U.S. support, is pushing hard to retake the city from ISIS militants. My BBC colleague Shaima Khalil was in the nearby city of Erbil, and she was speaking with people who managed to escape the fighting around Mosul. Shaima joins me now from her base in Qatar. So tell us who you met, Shaima, and what were their emotions having escaped the grip of ISIS?
Well, I managed to meet the Shahoud family. They had just been in the Khazar camp, which was about 30 minutes from where I was in Erbil. They were there 3 days, and they said that for the first time in more than 2 years, they were able to sleep well. And when I asked them why, they said because it was the first time that they were able to sleep without the fear of being punished by the so-called Islamic State. And the reason for that was that their youngest son, Ashraf, who's 17 years old, was abducted a few months back by IS fighters because they accused the family of having two other sons, his brothers, who had, according to them, joined the Kurdish Peshmerga forces. This wasn't true, according to the family, but the IS fighters still accused them of joining the Peshmerga forces, and they tortured young Ashraf for 7 hours. And wow. While we were sitting in their tent, his mother was crying as Ashraf described to me what had happened to him. So he was abducted, taken into a tunnel and then into a house far away. And he said they just kept lashing me and hitting me and smashing my head against a wall. And they kept asking, where are your brothers? Which mountain are they fighting us from? Your brothers are Peshmerga. And whenever he said, look, my brothers are nothing of the sort, he said they kept hitting me harder. And then he showed me a bruise on his arm. And I said, is that from the beating? And he said, no, that's from the electric shock. And then he went on to describe how by the end of it, his face was swollen, his lips were swollen, he couldn't feel his back. But then he said they put a knife against my neck and they kept firing over his head. And what he didn't know was that his mother at that point and his father had followed the car that had taken him and were begging literally for his life outside that house. His mother, through her tears, told me, I just stood in front of those IS fighters. And it's not a usual scene because normally IS fighters don't speak to women. Women aren't allowed to speak to them. They cover their face. But she said, I just stood there and I said, take me, put a bullet in me, but leave my son alone.
Wow, what incredible bravery.
Absolutely. And she said at this point, she felt like she just had nothing to lose because it was her son. But she also said that the minute that she had begged for her son's life and said, put a bullet in me, but not in my son, she'd heard gunshots. Of course, her son wasn't killed, but it was just for pure fear.
Do you have a sense, Shaima, of any details of daily life under ISIS in Mosul?
We actually spoke to another woman in another camp, and she'd been in that camp for 2 years. And she said her two brothers were still trapped in Mosul. And I said, well, how are they doing? She said, to be honest, I don't know anything about them. The calls are quite sporadic, but she did hear from them a day or two after the offensive for Mosul had begun. And she said, first of all, they were in hiding, because if you are caught with a mobile phone, that's enough to get you killed under IS rule, especially in Mosul at this point, because you're seen as an informant. So they were hiding their mobile phones. They spoke to their sister, and one of them who basically said, look, we're holed up in our houses. Our houses are like prisons. We lock ourselves up. We don't want to go out because we don't know what's out there. We're running out of food. We're running out of water. But more crucially, we're running out of milk for children. And then she said, my brother cried. And she said, you know, in our culture, it's not easy for a man to cry. But he just said, I don't know what to do. The children are hungry. We are hungry. And sometimes we have to go days without food just because they're too scared to leave the house.
Some of these escapees from IS showed you a special stamp that IS had put on their ID cards.
Yes.
I mean, I don't really know how to describe it other than kind of a visa for living your life. What did these people say about those stamps?
Well, I was very curious to know what daily life was like. If you were ill and you needed to go to the doctor, if your car was broken down and you needed to fix it, if you needed to buy a refrigerator. And they said anything of that sort had to come with a stamp, because if it didn't come with a stamp, it didn't count. And that tells you that it was IS trying to prove to them, but also to the world, that they're not just another militant group, that they're actually a caliphate. And what it says, it's a big blue stamp, and it looks semi-official, as you know, a stamp that you would get in any country in the Middle East just to make any document official. On it, it says Ad-Dawla al-Islamiyya, or the Islamic State, and then Dawlat al-Khilafah, or the Caliphate, and then Islamic Police. But they basically said you needed that for everything. And it's yet another facet of life there, of the Islamic State saying that we're in charge now, and we have our own stamps, we have our own bureaucracy, if you may, and you live under it.
My colleague at the BBC, Shaima Khalil, speaking with us about her recent visit to northern Iraq, checking in on the assault on Mosul and the refugees who have escaped from Mosul. Shaima, thank you very much.
Pleasure to be with you.
Britain's path out of the European Union just got a lot more complicated. The British government had been planning to start the process early next year. That made sense after a majority of voters favored the so-called Brexit in a referendum a few months back. Now Britain's High Court has ruled that there can be no Brexit until Parliament votes on it. After the ruling, the woman who brought the case spoke on the steps outside the court.
The result today is about all of us. It's not about me or my team. It's about our United Kingdom and all our futures. It's not about how anyone voted. Every one of us voted for the best country and the best future.
Her name is Gina Miller. She's not a politician. She's a British Guyanese investment manager who's never previously played a role in British politics. Chris Newlands has interviewed Miller for the Financial Times in London.
She's played a pivotal role. I mean, she's brought the case along with a few other people, notably a hairdresser. She's been absolutely pivotal. She's the one who has kind of taken a stand and acted.
Yeah, what was it like meeting her?
I met her in April. I mean, I've met her quite a few times. She works in the world of investment management. She runs a company, so you know, I've come into contact with her as a financial journalist. She is very, very outspoken. She doesn't really suffer fools.
I know that when you spoke with her, she described some of the racism she had experienced as a foreign-born black British woman in the finance industry. What was that like? What'd she tell you?
She told me she had a nickname, which was the Black Widow Spider, which, you know, frankly is...
A name she embraced, or a name that she was kind of battling with?
Well, you know, it's a name that she is completely battling with, has disgusted her. Fund management industry in the UK is, you know, it's very white, male-dominated, and she kind of sticks out like a sore thumb, really. An ethnic woman, she's very outspoken. She picks on causes, and she's kind of done that throughout her career. And this seems to be another one with Brexit, an almighty one, but another one.
Yeah, so how has she addressed racism and xenophobia in this week's events in court?
I know a lot of people have a problem with her roots and see her as an outsider trying to interfere with British politics. I know she's had death threats on Twitter and her social media. I mean, she really has been cast out here for how she looks, basically, I think.
she's the face of anti-Brexit right now. Is that right? I mean,
completely. Yeah, completely. I mean, you know, she's completely brought out a kind of an underbelly of hate, really. You know, and that's. I don't know if she expected that to happen. I think she probably didn't even think about it. She picks her battles and she picks her fights, and I don't think she thinks about the consequences. As she told me in the interview, she likes to stand up for people and for a lot of people who want to remain in the EU. She certainly stood up for them.
As someone who, as you say, doesn't suffer fools, how is she dealing with this kind of reaction to who she is, her identity?
I think she's just taking it on the chin. I've actually got a conversation with her later today, and I'm certainly going to ask her how she's dealing with it. I think because the country is so polarized, I mean, she is getting a lot of support for her actions, but she's certainly also being attacked by those who feel this means Brexit will be halted. She says she's not interfering in politics here. She says it's just a process for her. But obviously a lot of people are very emotional. They find this a very emotional topic about leaving the EU, and she's interfering with that as far as they're concerned.
There was that horrible case of the MP Joe Cox, who was killed in the lead up to Brexit. Does Gina Miller worry about her safety?
It's difficult to know that really without speaking to her, but I would assume so. You know, she has had death threats on Twitter, but Twitter is Twitter. It's not real life. So it's hard to say, but obviously this is a very emotional subject for a lot of people.
Chris Newlands with the Financial Times, thanks very much.
Thank you.
If you've had the chance to visit Harlem in the past decade, you may have noticed that a lot of West Africans now live in the neighborhood, especially Senegalese. The several blocks around 116th Street, in fact, are called Little Senegal. That's one reason why the U.S. election is being followed very closely back in Senegal, and there's a lot of concern there about all the anti-immigrant talk from Donald Trump. But at least some Senegalese are having a good laugh about it, too.
Good morning. Hi.
Hi.
My name is Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Yes. Future President of America.
That's Kuchia, a comedian in Dakar. He goes by just one name, but ask most Senegalese and they'll know exactly who he is. In fact, his popular TV show is simply called Kuchia Show. As you just heard, Kuchia has been impersonating Trump. He found a wig at a women's hair salon in Dakar and adjusted it to create Trump's massive cowlick. And his face makeup is white, even though that's not the color most satirists have settled on as Trump's primary skin tone. Senegalese audiences in Dakar and in New York love it. That's what New York-based Senegalese journalist Dam Babu told me.
I can tell you that is one of the most watched shows in the community here, including even compared to the U.S. television. They watch Kuchia Show more than the shows from the U.S.
Here in the U.S., you can watch Kuchia online. Here's a bit from one recent episode.
Bugonga Japalema, Hillary Clinton, Bobby Olbotukumo, crazy stuff.
Hillary Clinton?
Yes. Faber, Goody Bachang Manmonek President. Lola Bogu.
Kuchia's Trump travels to a village in Africa to meet a shaman.
Obama! Oh, Obama! Confirajar! Suma Hell Dalna! Okay!
The comedian walked me through the sketch, which is in Wolof, the main language of Senegal.
Donald Trump a un dernier moment pensé que peut-être seuls les marabouts d'Afrique.
The conceit here is that Trump thinks he should consult an African shaman because only a shaman, Trump has heard, would give him the power to be elected. So he goes to Africa and meets a wild-eyed master of black magic who tells him about all the leaders he's empowered with his spells. Barack Obama, Thabo Mbeki of South Africa, Nicolas Sarkozy of France.
Oh, Sarkozy, France!
But as it turns out, Trump is in the same village where a different shaman is giving Hillary Clinton a magic potion that would give her special powers.
Hillary, get up! She's a very marabout gumaga.
So what's the appeal for a Senegalese comedian of diving in so deep into the U.S. election? It has everything to do with Kuchia's boss, the owner of the TV station where he works, Youssou N'Dour.
Parce que le président directeur général du groupe là où je travaille, Youssou N'Dour, a eu l'idée.
The Grammy Award-winning singer parlayed some of his success into broadcast media in Senegal. He owns and operates one of the biggest networks there, TFM, Tele Future Media. And Youssou N'Dour, Kutia told me, knew that with our election, a lot of Senegalese eyes are in the United States. N'Dour wanted his country people to be aware of the things Donald Trump has been saying, so he asked Kutia to come up with his act.
Donald Trump parlait de l'immigration.
Kutia's blonde wig helps, but really he doesn't look a thing like Donald Trump. Still, Kutia's show has launched a discussion among Senegalese expats in the U.S. about Trump, a candidate they generally don't like. It's actually a bitter relationship that goes back to the 1980s, when Senegalese peddlers tried hawking their wares in front of Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue in New York. Trump alleged at the time that the Senegalese were part of a scam, trafficking in stolen merchandise, and that most of them, according to Trump, worked for, quote, a small band of extremely wealthy people who probably have big homes in New Jersey and Connecticut. The peddlers all denied that, but now the rivalry is alive again. And journalist Dam Babou in New York says, for many Senegalese here, Kutia show is not just entertainment.
In the community, you have still a large number of people who are not really fluent in English, so I'm not sure they get it when Donald Trump says it. But when satire comes with Kutia, it looks like they may almost take it like when you watch The Daily Show. It's like news to them, too.
The News of the World in Wolof. Here's some more Wolof, courtesy of Kutia's boss, the aforementioned Youssou N'Dour, from his most recent live album. I'm Marco Werman with The World. It is still too early to say that Colombia's long war is over. Just weeks ago, voters there rejected a peace deal. But peace talks continue, and in those negotiations, women are front and center. Research shows that in post-conflict countries where women are recognized as victims and given access to justice, peace is more likely to last. Realistically, though, how much justice can Colombian women expect? The World's Jasmine Garst has our story.
If you ever want to know what it feels like to be completely free, Yolanda Perea Mosquera recommends you go down to the town of Rio Sucio, or Dirty River. Inquire about a horse named Paloma. It was gifted to her as a child.
Montar a caballo es ser libre. O sea, uno montas un caballo andar.
To ride a horse is to be free. You ride a horse on the bare savanna, it's pure green, and that pure air hits your forehead. You feel like you own the world. That's how I felt, like I own the world.
If you ever want to know what it's like to be completely terrified, Yolanda also wants to talk about that. The houses in the Colombian countryside often have dirt floors and no doors, only open doorways. So one night, a masked guerrilla fighter slipped in. She was 11. He was much bigger than her, and he had a gun.
He left, and I hid in the back of the stable. My mom found me. She picked me up, and my clothing was covered in blood.
This is when life unraveled. She says she lost the concept of time.
The only thing I still liked to do was go fishing. It distracted me. I would look at that water, and it was clean. And I wondered if I jumped in, if the water would wash away this filth I felt at times. It was like a filth on my body, and I couldn't get it off.
Several weeks later, Yolanda miscarried. She didn't know she was pregnant. Her mother went to report the assault to the rebel commander. He called Yolanda a liar. Soon after, several guerrilla fighters showed up at the house. Yolanda followed her mom to the door.
She put her hand on my chest and she said, "No. Listen to me, Maria Yolanda Perea Mosquera. You aren't coming with me. You're going to take care of your brothers."
It was the last words the two ever spoke. Yolanda went off to the kitchen.
When I got there, it started raining bullets.
There's this word that keeps coming up when I speak to victims of the Colombian War. Venganza. Revenge. Some say they no longer need it. Many would still like to have it. And somewhere in the town of Rio Sucio, it was all 11-year-old Yolanda could think about.
Un momento que en serio yo quise hacer parte de la guerrilla solo por vengarme.
I wanted to join the guerrilla just to get revenge. I wanted them to teach me to make bombs, grenades, whatever they did to kill people. And then I was going to turn around and kill them.
They didn't let her join. You're too angry, they told her.
And I said, I better come up with something else. When the guerrilla fighters were thirsty, sometimes they would come asking for water or juice. So I made a juice. I mixed it with a chemical I used to disinfect the animals. I got dressed. I headed to the guerrilla camp. My plan was to give it to the man who had hurt me. And on the way, I ran into my cousin. And he said he was thirsty and could he have a drink? I froze. I dropped the jar and spilled the juice on the ground. And that's when I said, I can't get revenge.
Colombians' widespread desire for vengeance might stem from the knowledge that justice for victims is a rare thing here. After over half a century of war, nearly a quarter of a million deaths, and 45,000 disappearances, there's just too many bones to sift through and not enough money to do it. And then there's the issue of women.
They lost their sons or their compañeros. And the second thing is that women suffered much more rapes and sexual humiliations than men.
Maria Emma Wills Obregón leads the Department of Gender and Women at Colombia's Historical Memory Commission.
The women they chose to be punished were those women who had a leadership role or who transgressed the codes they had established in these villages.
It wasn't until the 90s, when the mass rapes in Rwanda and Yugoslavia came to light, that the UN defined rape in war as a crime against humanity. A few years ago, Colombia followed suit.
You know, we have worked so hard to, you know, speak out about sexual violence, speak out about women's rights.
Catalina Maria Diaz heads Colombia's Department of Transitional Justice. She says a lot of victims just want acknowledgement.
I think it's very clear that victims want the truth. They wanted the person responsible acknowledging what happened. Because some victims even experienced these accusations of being liars.
So when Colombia recently started hammering out a deal with the guerrillas, there was a lot of pressure on the government to focus on women. And it worked. The agreement had an entire chapter on victims' rights, which
included the creation of a truth commission, and that truth commission included a specific gender team.
The agreement was hailed as one of the most inclusive peace deals ever written. And then, a few weeks ago, a slim majority of Colombians voted against it. They said it was just too lenient on war criminals. They wanted more punishment. But not Yolanda.
Sí, yo voté por el sí.
I voted yes. And if I have to do it again, I'll vote yes again.
Yolanda gets it, the desire for justice and punishment. The chances that she'll get either are very slim. It's been over 2 decades since her assault. And here's the thing. War rapes are extremely hard to prove. The evidence is gone. And Yolanda has no idea who raped her. She might have come close to finding out a few years ago. She was working on a government-sponsored project. She and other victims were traveling the country by bus, sharing their stories with different communities, a sort of museum on wheels.
And this man stopped by. He specifically wanted to hear my story. He started crying. I got close to him and put my hand on his shoulder. And then he told me that around that time, he had been a rebel fighter in my town. I told him, don't worry. These things happened. We have to move on.
The former fighter left, and Yolanda got off the bus. She broke down in tears, kicking the bus tires furiously.
Y ahí entendí que la vida da tantas vueltas.
And that's when I got it.
Que cada momento nos coloca.
Life takes a lot of turns, preciso. And each moment puts us in the right place to get rid of our hatred.
A few years ago, Yolanda started up an organization for young Afro-Colombian women, victims of the war, to teach them about their rights. In her free time, she goes fishing with her daughter. For The World, Jasmine Garst, Colombia.
You can check out all of Jasmine's stories from Colombia and more from our Across Women's Lives team at pri.org/womenslives. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, wishing you a peaceful weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.